There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
A very good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Coming up, we're focusing on the finance of food as the giant Gulf Food Exhibition gets underway in Dubai. We'll find out what Brandy Scott's been doing on her book tour of New Zealand and Australia. Plus, we'll discover how wealthy Middle East investors are investing their money. But we begin with food, in particular, cheese. We learn how Italy's $2 billion Parmigiano, or Parmesan cheese industry, has rebuilt itself following a devastating earthquake in 2012.
Cheese, please! That's what I feel like, get some cheese! Any kind of cheese! Mozzarella? Parmesan
cheese, that's what we're talking about now. That's from Ratatouille, the movie. Thanks to producer Shruti for picking that one out of the archives. Here's the deal. Parmesan cheese, or Parmigiano Reggiano as it's formerly known, has faced a lot of challenges lately. Partly, there are imitators who would like to copy it. It's only original if it's from about 300 dairies in a specific part of Italy. But also in 2012, they were hit by an earthquake. And Parmigiano is made in these huge wheels of cheese, which is stored on shelves, which is where it ages. And when the earthquake struck, hundreds of thousands of these were destroyed. And that had the industry, the Italian food industry, rallying round to try and save it. It's a 2 billion euro a year industry, so it means a lot to that part of Italy. Massimo Buttura is an Italian restaurateur. He's the chef at Osteria Francesciana, which is a restaurant in Modena in Italy, which has 3 Michelin stars. And that is in the heart of the region that produces Parmigiano, or Parmesan as it's also known. Anyway, he was in our studios for Afternoons with Helen Farmer, talking to her about his food. But we spoke to him on the Business Breakfast about this extremely important business issue related to Parmigiano, in particular, the rebuilding process that took place after 2012. And we began by asking him about what happened in 2012 and why he got involved in the efforts to revive the Parmesan industry.
First, Instagram, there was about a picture of thousands of wheels of Parmigiano damaged, not destroyed, damaged by the earthquake and the shaking, you know, came to me and Eat and the Osteria and say, we need your help. We need your help. When people ask for help, I'm always ready. I came out with this idea of create a recipe in which we had to use a lot of Parmigiano Reggiano.
So what he did was to come up with a recipe that would use this broken cheese. Because as he said, it wasn't damaged, it was just broken. It didn't look nice, it's not in the nice kind of triangular form that people like to buy it in the shops. So he came up with something, he came up with a marketing ploy to try and get people to use this broken, still perfect, but broken Parmigiano. This is what he did.
The recipe was extremely well received, and we presented worldwide. In that moment, more than 40,000 people, they were listening and cooking, you know, this recipe all over the world. But the idea reached so many people, from Buenos Aires to Alaska, from Hong Kong to, you know, Moscow.
And it did help to save the day.
In 2.5-3 months, we sold the whole 360,000 wheels of Parmigiano, and no one lost the job. No one company closed. This was a recipe as a social gesture. This is the way I use art as an inspiration.
To put that in some kind of economic context, 360,000 wheels of Parmigiano is equivalent to about 200 million euros, or almost a billion dirhams. It would have gone to waste were it not for this campaign. So a lot of people very grateful for the efforts of Chef Massimo and many, many other people in getting people to eat that broken but still perfect Parmigiano. Right, that was 2012. Back in 2019 in Dubai, Gulf Food is happening this week. 5,000 exhibitors from around the world, including the Parmigiano Reggiano Consortium. They want to boost sales here in the Middle East. Fabrizio Raimondi is their official spokesperson. He joins us in the studio, and I asked them how much Parmigiano they're selling here at the moment?
It's big at the moment. It's the most important market in the Arabian Peninsula, but it's just at the moment it's just 400 tons exporting every year. So we think we can increase it a lot, also because many people in the Emirates think the real Parmesan it's the Parmesan, the fake Parmesan, but there is a huge difference between the authentic Parmigiano Reggiano and Parmesan. So we can do more.
Let's talk about this, because when we think of Parmesan cheese or Parmigiano Reggiano, stuff that we grate on our pasta and other things as well, there's been a huge intellectual property battle, hasn't there, particularly in Europe where you're from Italy, about who can call their cheese Parmesan cheese. And a European court has ruled that only the 300 or so dairies in your area of Italy can officially call themselves Parmigiano Reggiano or Parmesan cheese. Explain why that's important.
Yes, in Europe, Parmesan and Parmigiano Reggiano are the same thing. So, as you told, the court declared that there is no other Parmesan in the world. So, it is a protected designation of origins, and it means that all Parmigiano Reggiano must be produced in the Emilia-Romagna region and in the small part of Lombardy. But outside Europe, we have lots of problems because we have no protection at all.
So I could walk into a supermarket today and buy some cheese labeled as Parmesan, but it could come from dairies where?
Exactly. Normally they come from US or from South America, and they have nothing to do with the real Parmigiano Reggiano. If you buy Parmigiano Reggiano, you have to look at the brand. So you need to read the logo Parmigiano Reggiano and the PDO certification. And it means it comes from Parma, it has no preservative, no additives, and it is the only genuine one.
In reality, technically, is there very much difference between
there
yourself and
there is a
huge
difference.
Apart from the location.
There is a huge difference because the feeding of the cattle, because of the fact Parmigiano Reggiano is linked to the area of origin. It means we use only forage from that area. Milk it's only Italian, and we have a complete traceability of all the chain. So it means we are sure it has no preservative, no additive, and the flavor is also, makes the difference, I mean.
I'm guessing that you as a region are probably swamped under Parmesan from other areas around the world. What percentage of the entire Parmesan market, if you can call it such, does Parmigiano Reggiano represent?
At the moment, our turnover is 2.2 billion. And we can believe half of the turnover is the fake Parmesan. So it's a really huge problem, almost in some countries such as the United States, because everybody, for example, put Parmesan in Caesar salad, which is very common everywhere in the world, but no one knows that in Caesar salad you should add the genuine Parmigiano Reggiano. So that's the reason why we are doing lots of PR in our most important markets. And we are also launching a new campaign in the Emirates, in Saudi Arabia, and in Kuwait to let the people know that they should order the real Parmigiano Reggiano.
And that's one of the challenges you face, intellectual property, and you spend a lot of time and effort on that. The other challenge we spoke about earlier with Chef Massimo was 2012 and the earthquake that happened in your part of the world. Just remind people who aren't familiar with it what happened in 2012 and the impact that it had on your industry. Tell people what happened to your cheese.
Many wheels will be has been destroyed, and so there was lots of help between the different producing and also the big chef, the influencer, the media to sell them out, also if they were damaged. And it was a success. In a few months, everything was the same as usual.
It's been great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for joining us. Fabrizio Raimondi is official spokesperson for Parmigiano Reggiano Consortium. Busy week for you down at Gulf Food. 5,000 exhibitors, so it's going to be competitive stuff. We wish you the best of luck with that.
Yes, I think it will be. It's my first experience at Gulf Food, so I'm very excited to go there.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Very good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Now, Rhys Llewellyn is the Market Development Manager at Meat Promotion Wales. It's an organisation to promote meat exports from Wales, part, of course, of the United Kingdom. He joined us in the studio to discuss how British beef farmers are battling Brexit, and he began by explaining how they want to boost sales in the Middle East to offset exports to Europe that they might lose during Brexit.
What we try and do is position Welsh lamb as a premium product. You know, we're very confident in the quality, the taste, the flavours, the textures of Welsh lamb, and therefore we sell it into the premium market. And if people are going to choose lamb, let them pick Welsh lamb as the one that they choose. And it's held us in good stead in many of our traditional markets across the EU for many a year. And it was nice to go to Waitrose yesterday in the Dubai Mall and see there, in the premium positioning on the meat counter, Welsh lamb.
But it's going to be tricky here. There's a market, obviously, for premium Welsh lamb, but this is a mutton market, isn't it, particularly, and has been for a long time. My mother-in-law's Indian. She will only buy mutton, and that's not sheep. It's goat here, and that's a staple. How do you crack into that market?
Well, the big job for us, I guess, is to get people to understand the difference that Welsh lamb gives people. So make them understand what Wales is, where Wales is, why is Wales different, and the meat that we produce, why is it better, why is it of that premium quality, why is the taste better, and so on. So that is the argument that we've got to win to get more customers.
I've always thought the sort of spring lamb out of Wales is some of the tastiest lamb you can possibly find, but it is so expensive. It is more than double the price of an ordinary bit of lamb. Do you think that Welsh lamb sales suffer here because of that premium price?
I wouldn't say that it suffers, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's very expensive to produce lamb in Wales. We can't produce at the scale New Zealand and Australia can produce. Therefore, we need to achieve that premium product so that we can sustain that.
But that's just the economics of you producing. That shouldn't really be in consideration when I go to Waitrose to buy that lamb, surely. I don't really understand that your economics are more expensive. I mean, if I'm going to get a similar product from somewhere else that's cheaper, why would I not do that?
If you want the finest and you want the best, and you're willing to pay for it.
Let's look at your biggest market. 93% of your products goes to the European Union at the moment. Wales, of course, part of the United Kingdom. At the moment, part of the European Union, a big trade bloc, but you've only got about 6 weeks left of that, 29th of March. Britain will leave the European Union. How is that going to impact your business?
Well, anything that hampers on the complete frictionless trade that we've got now is going to be an issue for us. You know, we've traditionally been selling into Germany, France, Italy, for many a year. The consumers know our product, value our product, and are willing to pay that premium price for it. So if there are any delays to it, if there are any added costs to it, it's going to be an issue for us. You know, if we fall out with a no deal situation, the World Trade Organization tariff on lamb is between 40% and 60%. And while the consumers are willing to pay a little bit more for a premium product, that is not going to be something that's going to be achievable for the consumer in the EU to palate.
What is your biggest single market?
It would be France.
France. Are there any substitutes? I mean, have you got anybody up and coming markets outside the EU that you can maybe turn to and develop?
Well, we're obviously looking at the Middle East as a potential market. We're looking at the Far East as well. We already sell into Hong Kong and Singapore. Japan has just opened up for us, so we've got export health certificates for Japan. And also North America. Canada is a market that's growing for us. You know, if Brexit has done us one favour, it has highlighted the fact that our eggs were in one basket and made us look further afield. So we are actively working to grow these markets, but at the moment they're nowhere near the size that we need them to take the place of the EU.
So Rhys, let me just clarify. If Brexit happens on March the 29th, and at the moment that's what will happen, 30th of March, people in France wake up, my birthday, and they go to the supermarket to buy their Welsh lamb, which they're a big fan of for all the reasons you state. How much more will it be? If it was 10 euros on the 28th of March, how much will it be on the 30th of March?
It could be getting close to 20 euros.
It could almost double.
Yeah.
What can be done to prevent that from happening?
Well, I it's hard to know what the government will do because, you know, we're looking at an industry and a way of life that is going to be damaged very seriously if this happens because, you know, the farmers aren't going to be able to produce it for much less. So it's something that the government are going to have to step in and look at some way of compensating.
Isn't there actually a compensation in the fact that European goods coming into the UK will be more expensive as well? So your competition, you could say, would be hampered by exactly the same thing you'll be hampered with your exports.
Yes, but we don't import any lamb from the EU at the moment. You know, it's not going to balance out in that way. You know, the main import of lamb is from New Zealand to us. And because of the seasonal nature of the product, it actually helps us because it comes in during the earlier part of the year, Reece, when we don't produce.
Fascinating stuff. Best of luck at Gulf Food this week. Reece Llewellyn is the Market Developing Manager at the Meat Promotion Wales organisation, pronounced in Welsh as
Habiki Cymru.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
A very good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Now we're going to find out where wealthy Middle East investors are investing their money. Biswajit Dasgupta is the Chief Investment Officer at Emirates Investment Bank. He talked us through their latest 2019 Gulf Wealth Report.
I think it's useful to put a certain amount of context before the report just so that you can compare well. One is the fact that the report is conducted across the GCC. So we choose 100 individuals from across the GCC. So this is not a UAE report, it's a GCC report. And the other thing to be kept in mind is the way surveys work this time around, the number of representatives from the national community is higher than usual. So approximately 90% of the respondents were from nationals across the GCC. Having said that, in terms of the sort of trends, what we have seen is a marked increase in optimism across the GCC about the economic prospects over the near and the medium term, to be honest.
What is your definition of a high net worth individual? Starting wealth of what?
So we look at high net individuals with a net worth of $2 million and above.
2 million. I mean, there are 60,000 high net worth individuals in the UAE alone with more than $1 million and many more times that in Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, there are the other four GCC countries. I don't know that your starting point is 2 million, but a sample of 100 interviewees, is that really enough to get a true flavour?
So, you know, when you do samples, you follow some sort of a statistical random selection. And these are professional organizations that actually do that sampling based on, as I said, statistical methods. So, yes, I guess it's representative to the extent that something like this can be representative in this market.
So drilling down into the facts, did those high net worth individuals get wealthier this year?
They did not get wealthier, but they did feel that things are starting to turn around. In fact, the focus of the survey is not so much to focus on the trend in their wealth as much as how they view the world going forward.
And how did it change over the last year? What they're looking at, what markets they're looking at, what perhaps jurisdictions they want to invest into?
Right. So, first of all, like I said, there is greater optimism overall. And in terms of the investment trends, the big change that we saw were more investments in their local businesses here and more allocation, interestingly, also to cash. In terms of regions, again, because of the greater optimism, the investment in the local market seems to be pretty high. Almost 78% is what I recall. About 22% of respondents continue to invest globally. And within that, approximately 45% focus on Asia as the preferred destination. And about 20% or so intend to invest outside the GCC, but in the MENA.
You said that the respondents in the survey were positive in general, but I remember the survey that you did 2 years ago in 2017 when the oil price was very low. Most high net worth individuals, according to your survey, felt that the current situation then was worse or unchanged than the previous year, but the the view for the next 3 to 5 years was a positive outlook. Strong majority of high net worth individuals optimistic for the global economy, 76%, and the Gulf economy, 75%. And those views haven't really changed. So why do you say that they're more positive now than they were a couple of years ago?
So the factors that they cited for their optimism, one is this sort of stabilization and improvement in the price of oil, which of course continues to affect the regional economies broadly. There are also, depending on which country you're talking about, optimism around, for instance, in Oman, around trade flows that have improved, in Kuwait, around the Northern Gulf Gateway projects, in UAE, around the upcoming events like the Expo. So there are different factors that have been supportive.
What sort of people did you talk to? A lot of the very wealthiest people here have come from ruling families, from government. Did you get access to those sort of people? Was it sort of private made money?
So about 64% of the respondents were actually entrepreneurs, and there are about 20-odd percent are, I think, professionals, lawyers, etc.
And you looked at as many people in the UAE as you did in Saudi Arabia. Why was that?
So in terms of the total impact on the GCC economy, Saudi and UAE are obviously the biggest contributors. So it only seemed fair to focus on those.
Thank you so much for giving your findings. Biswajit Dasgupta, CIO at Emirates Investment Bank. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Very good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap.
Paperback writer.
You've been catching up with a paperback writer of some acclaim, Malcolm Taylor.
Yes, I don't know if she's coming out in hardback. It's Brandy Scott, of course. She's now an author and she's published her first book, and it's on sale in Australia and New Zealand, going on sale soon in the European Union and UK, but before that, the US. She is going to be a globally renowned author, and that's what's happening to her at the moment, the start of the journey in Australia and her home country, New Zealand. Brandy is down there pushing her latest book called Not Bad People. She sent us a little update last week. She was in Sydney heading off to Melbourne, and now she's in the depth of country Victoria with her latest update. And she said to me, look, if you listen carefully in the background, you can hear not Australians, but cows mooing to prove where she is. This is Brandy Scott.
Hello from country Victoria, where I'm sitting on a rocker on a veranda watching the sunset and listening to the cicadas. I've just finished up 3 days of book signing and interviews in Melbourne. Interestingly, everyone so far in Australia who's interviewed me has assumed that I am an Australian. The book is set in Australia. And I have to admit, I haven't done anything to dissuade them, which might be a little bit disingenuous of me. But I'm learning a lot about how the book selling works. For instance, every book that I sign is effectively a book that is then sold, because the booksellers can't return them once they have my signature in them. So how big the stack that they present you with to sign when you walk into their bookstore shows how much faith they have in that they will actually move it. But it does seem to be going quite well, and the stacks seem quite big. W.H. Smith has highlighted me as a fresh talent, which means that in all of their bookstores, which are in the airports and the train stations, there's big signs, which is really lovely, and I've been taking a few self-conscious selfies in front of those. I have also started rearranging the books to my advantage, making sure that they are at eye level, which is apparently the best spot. That's where you want them, so that people see them the moment they walk in. But I am told that every single author secretly does that. And then tomorrow, I'm off to Auckland for more of the same.
So we'll get more updates from Brandy, but she's been doing a bit of what the people in the supermarket call merchandising. You know, it's putting their products in front of other books. I'm sure she's shoved Leanne Moriarty to the back shelf and put Brandy Scott, knowing Brandy. But as she said, everyone does that as well. And you could hear the cows in the background there. So she was also in very rural. I mean, I'm not sure whether she was signing books out in the middle of nowhere or whether she was heading into Melbourne to do that. But
it's actually, the farm is owned by a mutual friend of ours,
yes.
Shana, who used to live in Dubai back in the day, then moved to Australia, to Melbourne, fine, many people do that, but then a year or two ago, just up sticks, left the city and bought a farm in the middle of nowhere, and those were her cows.
Brilliant. Yeah, sounds absolutely fantastic. So she's in New Zealand now and flew out overnight, and we look forward to getting more updates from Brandy. Good luck to her with that. I'm sure she won't be listening. She might be catching up at some point during the day, and we wish her all the very best, because it's kind of one of our own. And these books that she's signing at the moment, people in years to come will say, look, I've got a first edition signed Brandy Scott, and it will be worth lots of money. Let's hope so. The book is called Not Bad People.
Well, we have actually had an update since we've been on air, because I got in touch with Brandy, because you that message you got from her overnight, and I got in touch with her because on her Instagram she's put a photograph of a book review from a newspaper that says, what does it take to be the next Leanne Moriarty, who's the darling of Australian fiction writers at the moment.
I'm sure Brandy's going to grow to hate Leanne Moriarty.
Well, in 3 years' time, it will be, what does it take to be the next Brandy Scott? But for now, it's a compliment. And HBO picked up, and Nicole Kidman picked up her book, Big Little Lies. So she's a superstar at the moment. And the newspaper said, Brandy Scott's deliciously readable Not Bad People is the next Leanne Moriarty, which is a huge compliment. But
absolutely.
It wasn't clear to me which newspaper it was from. So I got in touch with Brandy this morning, and she said it's the Daily Telegraph in Australia. And she sent me this update by WhatsApp after that.
Fabulously, funniest thing that's happened to me so far. I went into a small country bookshop and they had a couple of copies of Not Bad People. And I said to the bookseller, oh, that's mine, I wrote that. He just looked at me and said, yeah, we're not selling very many, love. Which is just brilliant. I cracked up. Yeah, just keeping my feet on the ground here.
Yes, before you fly too high, we're not selling very many, love.
That's Brandy Scott in New Zealand.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
That's it for the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Don't forget, we're back live on air tomorrow morning with the Business Breakfast Breakfast from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.